The high at 86%. And it's 10 past 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Just when you think that every possible book about the Kennedys, the Kennedy family, has been written, and every story told very thoroughly, along comes yet another book that sheds new light on this fascinating American family. This book has just crossed my path, and I am so glad it did. The book is titled The Kennedys in the World: How Jack, Bobby, and Ted Remade America's Empire. It is the work of Lawrence J. Haas, whose previous books includes Harry and Arthur, Truman Vandenberg, and the Partnership That Created the Free World. In somewhat the same spirit, this new book by Lawrence J. Haas explores the legacy of John, Robert, and Ted Kennedy in a way that perhaps has not been so thoroughly examined before, namely the way in which they viewed the world and America's place in the world, and what they believed to be the role that America should play in a complex and often dangerous world. And in some respects, their perspectives changed over time, and in many fascinating ways, their perspective on the world and America's place in the world was at dramatic odds with the perspective of their own father, Joe Kennedy, who was a fervent isolationist, at least at many points in his life. So all of this sets up a fascinating family dynamic and certainly an important legacy in terms of America's history, and a story which is a sprawling one in terms of length of time. We are talking about more than six decades that these three men at various points were in public office between the years 1946 and 2009. The book again is titled The Kennedys in the World: How Jack, Bobby, and Ted Remade America's Empire, published by Potomac Books, an imprint of the University of Nebraska Press. And Lawrence J. Haas, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm really glad we can have this this conversation. At what point did it occur to you that this particular facet of the Kennedy brothers was something that was not yet fully appreciated and needed to be written about?
Well, I had done some reading about Jack and Bobby in particular over the course of time through research on other issues and the rest. And also, I worked as a journalist in Washington for a whole number of years and watched Ted Kennedy up front. And when I watched him on foreign policy, which is not something that people associate with him, I was quite intrigued by what I was hearing him say and watching him do. So when I became intrigued, I looked more into Ted's record, and I read more about the three brothers in general, and I came to discover this new story, which in essence is that everybody knows that Joe and Rose Kennedy groomed the three boys for success. to attain power and to do something with it. But what almost nobody knows is that they groomed them to achieve a certain kind of success, to look across America's borders, to learn about the world, to care about the world, and once they attain power, to shape America's role in the world, and through that, to change the world itself. And the book is all about how they were raised, what they were taught at the breakfast and dinner table, where they traveled, what they wrote, and how they incorporated all of this education and all of this travel in later years, once they attained power, to actually reshape America's global role. And they address not just broad issues of war and peace, but virtually every major global challenge that the United States faced on their watch. So from the Soviet Union to China to Cuba to Latin America to challenges in Africa to challenges in the Middle East to Asia and all the rest. So it is, as you say, a sprawling history and a rich new story. So I was excited about researching it and about writing it, and now I'm terribly excited to discuss it with you.
There are a couple of aspects about your sort of voyage of discovery, if we want to call it that, in terms of really uncovering more and more about this story in its richest details. And you talk about this at some point, that part of this involved thorough exploration of all kinds of records that perhaps have not been thoroughly explored before. And the other thing is, in a sense, a little bit about a sense of time and the possibility of looking back on some of these events with a different sort of perspective than one might not have as these events were actually unfolding. Let's begin with the first. What would be some of the most important and beneficial resources that you were able to explore that really helped to bring this story to life?
Well, I would mention, first of all, the hundreds, literally hundreds, of oral history interviews about Jack and Bobby, and those are at the JFK Library in Massachusetts, and oral histories about Ted Kennedy that are located at what's called the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. A lot of historians do not pay much attention to oral histories for some reason, and I find them terribly revealing. What oral histories are, in essence, are interviews with people. And, you know, they tend to be either just on tape or they are transcribed. Fortunately, it saved me a lot of work because they are the ones for Jack and Bobby are transcribed and available online from the JFK Library. The ones for Ted Kennedy, which are really unexplored, as far as I can tell, by other historians, are terribly rich in detail. And this is, you know, public officials who served with Ted Kennedy, family members, friends, other kinds of colleagues from all different stages of Ted Kennedy's life. And they reveal anecdotes and conversations and observations, all of which, you know, provide really interesting and rich insights about the three brothers. So that's one thing I would say. Secondly, there's another thing that a lot of historians do not tend to pay much or as much attention to as I think they should, which is contemporary news coverage of the events. So if I was interested in finding out what Jack was doing on a particular issue, I researched the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the same for Bobby and Ted over the course of years. And you read newspaper stories And you find these just fascinating tidbits about what they said, what they did, how other people interpreted their behavior. And all of that paints a picture. You know, all of these insights give you something to think about, and they come together and you say, ah, this is the broader theme here in this person's life, or these are the broader themes that bring together these three brothers. This is the continuity. This is the discontinuity. So I think those two things, you know, in particular, there's obviously reams of other research. I mean, all three brothers wrote books, kept rich diaries, wrote magazine and newspaper articles. And there's obviously, you know, plenty of stuff that's been explored by other historians. And if you want to dig into a subject, you do need to ground yourself in what others have written about them. So, you know, as I look around my office here as we speak, scores of books about the Kennedys, but well beyond that, you know, just many feet of files about all of the different things that I mentioned a second ago, the oral histories, the newspaper coverage, the articles and diaries that they kept, and all the rest. So I know I'm leaving out a lot, but those are the things that come to mind when I sort of think about what's the special nature of the research that I did that allowed me to discover a story that no one else had discovered yet.
Hmm. What about this other matter involving what I think at one point you characterized as fresh new reflections, which suggests a perspective that is only possible when one is looking back in hindsight and viewing events in that respect. Is it simply a matter of just letting time go by, or is there more to it when it comes to reflecting on these things in new and fresh ways?
So I think it's two things. I think that time is important. The further you get away from the emotions of the moment, the battles of the moment, the more that you're not in the center of the storm, the more that you can have balanced perspective about what had happened in previous years. That's one thing. But yet at the same time, we are all products of our time. And, you know, you mentioned my previous book, Harry and Arthur, about the late 1940s and the development of the free world. And now this book about the Kennedys and America's role in the world over the course of more than six decades. You know, I'm a product of my time, just like any historian would be a product of their time. And we have had, over the course of the last 8 to 12 years in America, a reassessment about what America's role ought to be. There was a certain stepping back under President Obama, but still a lot of engagement. Then there was a move towards isolationism under President Trump. And now you see with President Biden an effort to reassert American leadership. So this has been a time of real ferment in which the nation has been reevaluating what America's role should be in the world. So that, frankly, sensitized me to that issue. So when I was doing research about the Kennedys and this issue just really hit me in the face, one of the reasons it resonated so much is because it really highlights the current debates that we're still in the midst of in terms of what should America do around the world? How bold should it be? How much should its interests be beyond simply defending its national security? How much should it be promoting freedom and democracy? How much should it be worrying about conflicts that are breaking out, you know, far from home? What is its national interest when it comes to, you know, protecting and defending its allies thousands of miles away across the globe? So it's the two things. It is the freshness that you get from years removed from an issue, but it is also the sensitivity that you get from the times that you are living in and how they apply to the history that you're discovering.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Lawrence J. Haas, author of The Kennedys in the World, How Jack, Bobby, and Ted Remade America's Empire. One of the things I most deeply appreciate about your book is that you take great cares to distinguish between John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Ted Kennedy, who at one point you say were hardly carbon copies of one another. And I think sometimes when we speak about the Kennedys collectively, and especially when we talk about the Kennedy brothers collectively, sometimes those distinctions can either be lost altogether or minimized. And you don't minimize those differences at all. At least in brief, just talk for a moment about the importance of thinking about these three men in contradistinction to each other. Thinking about the ways in which they were different from one another and not just the ways in which they were the same.
Right. So, you know, we have this image of the Kennedy family, always tight-knit, always getting along with one another and all the rest. And the truth of the matter is that the Kennedy family was what today we would call dysfunctional in many ways. But it's not something that people have paid a lot of attention to. But yes, the three brothers, from the way they were raised and the particular struggles that they had, actually grew up much different from one another. Jack had it pretty rough when he was growing up. He deeply resented the fact that his mother was very cold to him, and had that bitterness throughout his life while he was close to his father, the way his mother raised him. His older brother, Joe Jr., the oldest brother, who died tragically at war in 1944 at the age of 29, was threatened by Jack and bullied and beat him quite regularly and badly, and once sent him to the hospital for 28 stitches. And at the same time, Jack had a wreck of a body, scarlet fever at 2 and serious back problems and stomach problems throughout his life, and it made life a chore every day. And somehow he used all of those struggles as a motivating factor to overcome. And it's actually a remarkable story. And not only does he overcome and attain great things, but he emerges as this very charming, carefree, light, funny, ironic personality. Bobby is the seventh of nine. He's a classic middle child. He is stuck between the older brothers, Joe Jr. and Jack, who look like they're, you know, groomed for stardom, and Ted, the youngest, who the family is doting on. And because of that, Bobby develops a need to prove himself. And it's not just in childhood, but it's throughout his life. He, you know, swims in dangerous waters, and he skis dangerous slopes, and he climbs dangerous mountains. And so, not surprisingly, at some stage in the 50s, early 1960s, when he's working for Jack, he develops this real brashness, and it reflects a certain recklessness in some of the advice that he gives to Jack on foreign affairs. Ted is the youngest. He grows up quite lonely, shuffled among 10 different schools in his youth. But he has the great fortune to spend a lot of time when he goes home from boarding school with his grandfather, the former Boston mayor, Honey Fitz, who's a terrific retail politician. And he watches Honey Fitz when they have lunch or they walk the streets of Boston, in Honey Fitz shaking hands and slapping backs and trading, offering condolences. And it's the reason why Ted Kennedy grows up and becomes such a terrific retail politician. And in the end, as I write in the book, he has a greater legacy in reshaping America's role than either Jack or Bobby, because he was so effective when it came to getting things done. When they were adults, all three of them, developed a real closeness that we associate with them. But in their youth, they were quite different and not close at all.
Hmm. Beyond highlighting some of the intriguing differences between them, I also appreciate the fact that the image that emerges of each of them is so complex. And in some cases, we're talking about people with traits that would seem, at least at a glance, to be almost contradictory to one another. And it just reminds us that all of us are complicated human beings, and that almost none of us can really be summed up in a single word. For instance, as you talk about Jack Kennedy, and I think your description of him is just so intriguing in part because it is so complete, but you talk about, you know, charm and wit and fun-loving and captivative personality and so on, and yet you also say he was the most cerebral of the three brothers. And it's just so interesting. We hardly ever think of somebody being cerebral who's also charming and witty and fun-loving. I mean, we just don't think about those things blending together, and they somehow did with Jack Kennedy.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. I think you're absolutely right in terms of what we think about, but there is a certain consistency here, and that is that on when it comes to being cerebral, he is, he spends many long weeks during many long illnesses in bed, whether he's at home or he's in a hospital or the rest. And he uses that opportunity to read voraciously. He reads massive amounts of history, lots of biography, and he really gets a very deep understanding of not only the United States, but the world writ large and how different America is, the traits, the cultures, the ideologies, and all the rest. Now, when it comes to the charm and the wit and all the rest that maybe we associate with a certain kind of superficiality, in fact, his wit is very sophisticated. It's very intellectual. In fact, at one point I write in the book that he's the center of any discussion that he's involved in. And when he's not in the middle of a conversation with somebody, he is inventing brain-teasing games just for fun. So the mind of Jack Kennedy is always at work. And even when he's carefree, it's a certain kind of sophisticated humor with a lot of irony and a lot of kind of intellectual charm to it. He's quoting poetry. He is citing historical works. And all of what wraps it together is this real depth that comes across whenever he is either talking to someone else or just spending time with himself and just thinking about things.
Mm. I love a quote from somebody that says that being with Jack Kennedy was like being at a fair. And
yes.
That's a really beautiful image, and we can kind of sense what that is all about. Robert Kennedy
is... I was just going to say the same person also said that his personality was sparkling. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm,
sparkling.
Yes. Robert Kennedy is no less complicated a figure in some respects, in part because, you know, he is looked on as the runt of the family and often very dour and nervous, and yet wanted to attempt all of these reckless things. And that's also a combination of traits that, in a sense, makes sense, but is not also something we might expect.
That's right. You know, I often think to myself, who is the most fascinating of the brothers? And I continue to debate whether it's Jack or Bobby. And Bobby is, while Jack is fascinating, Bobby is also terribly fascinating. I mentioned before that, you know, he's a classic middle child. He's sort of squeezed between Joe Jr. and Jack on one end and Ted at the other end. He's extremely awkward as he's growing up. He often has got his head kind of buried in his neck as a child. He's so shy, has trouble speaking. Even as an adult, sometimes when he's about to give an important speech, his hands are shaking. At one point, he said to someone well into adulthood, he said, "Sometimes I wish I never was born." So he was a person who dealt with demons throughout his life. And because he was a middle child, it was this demon of proving that he's that he measures up to being a Kennedy. So that's why you get this kind of bravery to the point of recklessness, the swimming, the skiing, the climbing that I mentioned before. When he was a public official, he was really brave to the point of recklessness in the sense that on his foreign travels, he would sometimes wade into hostile crowds, even when his security details could not guarantee his safety. And he showed no reluctance. He would just do it. And sometimes he'd be hit by eggs and tomatoes, and protesters would spit on him. This was when he was traveling, you know, at the height of the Cold War. He's Jack's attorney general, but also his top foreign policy advisor. And he takes a global goodwill tour across Europe and Asia in 1962. And in some of these places, he is met by communist students who are challenging him as a representative of imperialistic America. But I really come away with great admiration for Bobby, because there really was no reluctance. When he felt something was really important, he really set aside all hesitancy for his own, you know, protection and pursued the greater cause. And it was all driven by this childhood sense of, I'm stuck in the middle, and my older brothers are going to be stars, and everyone's paying attention to my younger brother, and where do I fit in, and I have to prove myself. Hmm.
As for Ted Kennedy, you say quite bluntly, of these three brothers, he was by far the best politician. And you've already said in this interview that his legacy in terms of in the arena of affecting foreign policy and America's place in the world is the most impressive. One thing you mentioned about his childhood, which was often lonely, was that he spent a great deal of time with his maternal grandfather, the legendary Honey Fitz. Something that you also touch on in your book is that even though he was shuffled between 10 different schools through the course of his childhood, he learned something from that. There was a benefit to having that kind of childhood. Explain what that benefit was and how richly it served him in his political career.
Well, he was forced to make friends quickly because he so often had to make new friends. I mean, think of it. Children begin to go to school at about the age of 6, and they complete high school at about the age of 18. So that's the course of 12 years, 10 schools in 12 years. So he is often going into a new environment, and to survive, he learns quickly how to reach out to people and make friends and build relationships. That, in combination with the more political skills that he learns from Honey Fitz, the shaking hands, the looking somebody in the eye, the putting your arm around someone, the offering condolences to someone who is hurting, all of these are human skills that help you build alliances. And in the course of trying to build support for an idea, a piece of legislation, they help you build coalition. So he's in the Senate from 1962 until 2009, so more than 40 years. And in the Senate, what's the game? I need to get 51 votes, 51 out of 100. And I've got to go, you know, some of these things are easy. They're obvious. But the really hard ones, you got to do it in a retail sense. You got to go visit people. You got to talk to them on the phone. You got to convince them to come your way. And sometimes it's an ideological argument, and sometimes it's a hardcore political argument. But at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is, do you get to 51 votes? Nobody over the course of recent decades, I don't even mean just as in terms of the Kennedys, nobody who served in the Senate in the post-World War II period did this better than Ted Kennedy. And when you evaluate U.S. senators over the course of time, everyone who has thought about this and kind of congressional scholars will tell you that Ted Kennedy is undoubtedly one of the top 10 U.S. senators of all time, and probably within the top five.
We're speaking with Lawrence J. Haas about his newest book, The Kennedys in the World: How Jack, Bobby, and Ted Remade America's Empire. It is a look at how the three Kennedy brothers were very much instrumental in shaping America's place in the world and the way in which we viewed the world and the way the world viewed us, in a sense. Although your book, of course, primarily focuses on the three Kennedy brothers, there would be no Kennedy brothers without Joe and Rose Kennedy. And, of course, your book, among other things, focuses on the kind of parents that they were and what was most important for them in terms of raising their children. One of the things that I find most curious is Joe Kennedy's isolationism. And that is a position that he staunchly held, even as events in Europe with the rise of Hitler grew more and more ominous. He remained a stubborn isolationist. And help us understand, first of all, where his sense of isolationism came from. What drew him to that position and led him to hold on to it so tenaciously? And then help us understand how an isolationist would nevertheless want his own sons to have a broad and wide-spanning sense of the world, because that seems like a little bit of a contradiction.
Yes, and I can see why people would think that. Well, I will say that, like other isolationists, Joe Kennedy was not terribly sensitive about what was at stake in the battle between freedom and democracy on one hand, and, you know, in his time, fascism or communism on the other hand. And he would, when he was ambassador to Great Britain in the late 1930s, get himself in trouble, because at the time when Roosevelt was trying to sensitize America to the threats from abroad, he was saying things like, well, basically, we shouldn't let the differences between the Western powers and the fascist powers interfere with getting along. We all share the same world. So he's very much kind of minimizing the differences. And you see this with isolationists. You know, frankly, they're much different people. But we saw that with an isolationist Donald Trump over the course of 4 years, where he very much minimized the differences between the free and democratic U.S.-led West and our allies in Europe and Asia, and autocratic regimes in Beijing, Moscow, Istanbul, and elsewhere. So why does he want the boys to go overseas? Well, if you're an isolationist, basically you are reluctant to believe that America should use its power and good offices to affect change. That is, you don't think that it's your job to, in essence, reshape the world. But what you do believe is that if the threats come back to America. That is, if we are attacked, we need to make sure that we have got the military, the resources, the wherewithal to protect ourselves. So how do you do that? You not just build up your military, but you learn about the world. Where are the threats likely to come from? Are they going to be from the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe? Are they going to be from Asia? Are they going to be from Africa? And one of the reasons that he sent the sons overseas to learn about the world was so that they would be better positioned to ensure that America could protect itself if attacked. Now, of course, from their education and their travels, they develop a much different view about what America's role in the world should be. But the motivation was that Joe wanted them to learn about the world so that they would better understand how America could protect itself, ward off threats, and ensure that it could defend itself if attacked. Hmm.
One of the really interesting journeys that occurs in your book is when we see, for instance, Jack Kennedy beginning his political career as what you call, being what you call at one point, the quintessential Cold Warrior, a warrior in the Cold War, and Bobby Kennedy, of course, right there beside him. When we think about the kind of Cold Warriors that they were in the 1950s, how closely should we group them with as distasteful and even repugnant a character as Joe McCarthy? I mean, did they have a more nuanced sense of what that battle was all about? Or by and large, were they caught up in that same anti-communism craze that Joe McCarthy helped foster?
Well, I think there's kind of a yes and no answer to that. I mean, there is no question that they were cold warriors, that is, anti-communist, that is, believing that America's greatest challenge around the world is to contain Soviet-led communism. They were just as strong on that subject as Joe McCarthy was. And frankly, it reflected the consensus of the times. So there was nothing particularly unusual about just how hardcore they were as hardcore Cold Warriors. And, you know, Joe McCarthy, as I mentioned in the book, is actually a family friend, and he dates, you know, some of the Kennedy sisters. And when Bobby and Ethel have their first child, Kathleen, who is now Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, they ask Joe McCarthy, and he agrees to be her godfather. So he was very much in the Kennedy orbit. But where they part company, of course, is on the tactical level, where Joe McCarthy really becomes out of control in the early 1950s with, you know, his, you know, attacks on, you know, civil liberties and due process and free speech and all the rest. They were a little slow to separate themselves from McCarthy. And in fact, in the vote to censor McCarthy after the Army-McCarthy hearings, in which there was a growing consensus that Joe McCarthy really had gone too far at this point, so this is like 1954, Jack Kennedy is very conveniently in a hospital suffering from a back injury, because he probably would have been reluctant, even though he would have known it's the right thing, he would have been reluctant, based on the family friendship and the long history with Joe McCarthy, to actually take the censor vote. 1957, at a fairly young age, Joe McCarthy dies from essentially alcoholism, and very quietly, while Bobby Kennedy understood all his faults, after all, he had worked for him as a Senate staffer and then quit over differences that he was having with McCarthy about the tactics that McCarthy was using. 1957, Bobby Kennedy very quietly attends Joe McCarthy's funeral. So they've got a very kind of interesting, almost ambivalent relationship with Joe McCarthy. They share the fervent anti-communism, but they split with him over the obviously outrageous tactics, attack on civil liberties and free speech and all the rest.
Right. Another interesting thing about Jack Kennedy, as you trace his short but dramatic presidency, is how his views on a number of matters related to foreign policy were beginning to shift. And had he not been cut down by an assassin's bullet in November of 1963, it's very likely, of course, that he would have been reelected and that he might have taken some intriguing courses of action, perhaps a bit different from what had been chosen early on in his presidency. Can you just kind of summarize for our listeners what I'm talking about, what would be most significant in terms of Jack Kennedy's shift in perspective when it came to foreign policy?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, we associate Jack Kennedy with certain high moments, and maybe none more so than the inaugural address, in which he says that we will, you know, pay any price, bear any burden for the survival of liberty. And it is a real call to arms. We are, you know, under attack by a very aggressive Soviet Union, and we've got to make sure that we confront them and not let them go any further. And there's a real, I don't want to say warlike mentality, that may be a little bit of an overstatement, but a real sense of dramatic urgency. And all through the course of that first year, I mean, Jack Kennedy has not only one State of the Union address, which he delivers in late January, soon after taking office, but he actually comes back to Congress in May to deliver a second State of the Union address to reinforce the urgency, essentially, of the Soviet challenge. Well, he, you know, is tempered by certain challenges. There's the Bay of Pigs in April of 61, which was clearly a misguided effort to topple Castro. That tempers him and seasons him a lot. In July of that first year, 1961, Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, is threatening to force the United States out of West Berlin, to seize the entire city, and to try to reunite Germany, which, as you know, was divided after World War II, under Soviet control as a fully communist state. And Jack's got real challenges in trying to, you know, make clear to Khrushchev that we're going to defend West Berlin, but at the same time, you know, avoid war with the Soviets. And then, of course, there's the Cuban Missile Crisis in late 62 that really shakes Jack and Khrushchev to their core, because they realize how close the world's two superpowers came to a nuclear war and a global disaster. And by the time you get to 63, when Jack is feeling like he's built up the military and he is feeling like in the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, he's got a better understanding with Khrushchev that this is only one world and we've got to share it, he delivers a magnificent speech at American University in June of 63, in which he talks about genuine peace, as he calls it, with the Soviet Union, the peace that makes life worth living, that we've got to, you know, we find communism repugnant, but we can still celebrate the accomplishments of the Soviet people, their scientists, their mathematicians, and all the rest. And he's really setting the stage for more cooperation over the long term with the Soviet Union. In late 63, they ink the Limited Test Ban Treaty, and they both think that in the months to come, they will agree on more arms control. And all of this is sort of a picture of more cooperation and less confrontation. And I'll say one more thing that relates to all of this is that by late 63, shortly before his assassination, Jack had made it abundantly clear to people in the White House, to people on Capitol Hill, and he was already hinting publicly that if reelected, as he expected in 1964, he was going to withdraw from Vietnam. He had about 18,000 military advisors there at their peak, no combat forces. He was already on the way to withdrawing some of them. He had told Defense Secretary Robert McNamara to plan for a year-long withdrawal over the course of 1965. He told Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield that he was going to withdraw. And in public interviews, he was making clear that he was growing disenchanted with the South Vietnamese President Diem because he wasn't making the social reforms that Jack thought were necessary to build support for the war effort in the South. So, yes, by 63, by late 63, you know, in the days before his assassination, Jack Kennedy was a much different person with a much different perspective than the fire-breathing Jack Kennedy who took office on January 20th of 1961.
In our last 2 minutes, I wish we had more time than this. I want you to at least touch on the fact that transformation was not limited to Jack Kennedy, but very much was a part of Bobby Kennedy and Ted Kennedy in the wake of their older brother's assassination. If we read your book, what will we learn about the way in which those two men were so drastically changed and their perspective changed?
Well, you know, up through Jack's death, they all are hardcore Cold Warriors just like Jack was. But what really sets them on the path to change is Vietnam, because Vietnam began as a Cold War venture under Jack. A place where the United States would, as Jack said, make a stand against Soviet expansionism. But what happens is Jack dies, President Johnson takes over, he changes the entire nature of that conflict from one of sending military advisors to one of sending combat troops. At its peak, he sends, you know, there are over 500,000 U.S. forces in Vietnam, and the more that Vietnam turns into a horror show, the more that Bobby and Ted question their earlier support for it and its connection to the Cold War. They are no less anti-communists, and they were anti-communists to their dying day. But from Vietnam, they begin to question the nature of this conflict and actually its connection to the Cold War itself. And over the course of time, and particularly Ted, who lives for, you know, several decades after Bobby dies in 68, you know, they become more skeptical of the use of American power overseas. It's reflected in, you know, Ted's opposition to both wars in Iraq in 91 and 2003 and some other military things that occur over the course of time. And they transform themselves largely, not exclusively, but largely driven by Vietnam. They transform from hardcore Cold Warriors into what we now think of them as, which is liberal humanitarian doves.
And the story of that transformation and all which they managed to accomplish is told, along with much more, in this fascinating book called The Kennedys in the World, How Jack, Bobby, and Ted Remade America's Empire, published by Potomac Books, an imprint of the University of Nebraska Press, and the author, Lawrence J. Haas. Thank you so much, Lawrence J. Haas, for giving the world this fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. What a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and I greatly appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we are excited to welcome back and into our studios, not just to the program, Dr. Art Sear, Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College and Director of the Clausen Center. We'll talk about the violence in the Middle East, recent British elections, and the first 100 days.